The teaching of the Bible alone is that sinners are saved by grace alone, through faith or belief alone, in Christ alone, so that all the glory goes to God alone.
The law is given for the knowledge of sin. It is not given for the justification of the believer. And that is the legal use of the law. To try to use the law in a way of justifying oneself is an illegal use of the law.
Protestant orthodoxy taught that man was a sinner, depraved in all his parts and functions, and therefore desperately in need of divine grace.
You're listening to Trinity Foundation Radio. I'm your host, Steve Matthews. Thanks for joining me for episode 26. Today, I have a special returning guest, someone whose name I'm sure would be familiar to many supporters of the Trinity Foundation. I'm talking here to Doug Dalma, and we will be talking about his brand new book. It's called The Grand Old Doc, and it is essays on the thought of, or articles, excuse me. It's The Grand Old Doc, articles on the thought of Gordon H. Clark. And Doug, welcome to the program today.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
All right. Well, it's exciting to have you here. You've had a lot going on here very recently. Not only did you just get this book published, you've also had a new addition to the family.
Yeah, I call last week was one of the greatest weeks in my life. Our third child, Evergreen, was born, Evergreen Daniel, and healthy, and mama's doing well also. And then the book got published, or I received a box of them from the Trinity Foundation, which is really quite a joy when that shows up. And then on Saturday, my football team won, so it was just wonderful. Sorry, all right. Sorry for those folks like yourself in that other Midwestern state.
for those who don't know, he's being polite here. He's referring to Michigan and Ohio State. There are a lot of, but you know, here's the thing. I did not go to Ohio State. I actually went to Cincinnati. So I'm a Bearcats fan. You've had a lot going on, a lot of excitement here. And it's really wonderful to have an opportunity to sit and talk with you about your book. And so just kind of turning to the book here, Doug, I wanted to ask you to start with, you titled it The Grand Old Doc, Articles on the Thought of Gordon H. Clark. So tell me a little bit about where that nickname Grand Old Doc comes from.
Yeah, I'll answer your question. I want to mention one other thing first. It's been great having the opportunity to be on the podcast, on the recording here, has given me an opportunity to read the book. And as things go, it took a little time to get everything through publishing. And some of these articles were written up to 3-4 years ago. So it was an opportunity for me to read my own book and to remember what I wrote. And try to refresh myself before coming to this. And as a book of articles, I was at one point saying, well, maybe this won't turn out very well. It's just scattered articles. But reading through it now, I've really been satisfied with the work. And I was thinking of, you remember the movie, Will Ferrell was in Anchorman some years ago, and he's very haughty. There's no humility. And I think there was an extra later on. I don't think it was in the movie. It was something afterwards. And he wrote a book, and he gives it his own endorsement on the front. And it says, this is a great book. So this is me last week. I'm reading my book and I'm going, oh, this is really good. So there are, of course, despite my efforts and the efforts of the editor and stuff, there are some small typos. When I wrote the biography, people would send me a list of typos, and it's like, all right, we're trying to get across some ideas here. Not trying to present our ability to be excellent grammarians, but really thankful for the Trinity Foundation to get this book out, and am happy with how it turned out. And we've got endorsements from a great selection of churchmen and philosophers and thinkers of various sorts. So to the question, the grand old doc, as the title of the book and the heading of the first chapter, the first article, it is explained in there that this term, along with another one, where I mentioned he's the grand patriarch, is the other one mentioned. But the grand old doc comes from a letter that Edward Carnell wrote to Gordon Clark. And then another letter I mention is Kenneth Conser's, former professor, who calls Gordon Clark the grand patriarch. And so using these two quotes together, we put together this idea that I put together this idea that Gordon Clark was the father figure of a lot of American evangelicalism. As you see things really changing sort of post-World War II in real resurgence of evangelical and eventually reformed theology, there's Clark sort of on the horizon or as a background figure, as the father figure of these many great men who were fighting for biblical inerrancy and a real return of the truth in Christendom. And I think Clark played a significant role in that, somewhat behind the scenes, perhaps.
Yeah, Clark seemed, his students, and I get the sense from even just reading the, you know, the book that you had here, his students seemed like they had a real love and respect for him.
Yeah, I think that's true. As with anybody, and especially as sort of a tough philosopher, there were people who didn't like him. He was challenging at times, which is required of a philosophy professor, and perhaps even mean on occasion. But in general, people really quite came to like him in most cases as a very endearing fellow, as I call him in one of the essays. Always a mixed reaction, but I think it would be wonderful to take a class under him with the jokes and the applications and the Socratic debates. It would be a real lively affair.
It would be. And, you know, it's interesting. Of course, I grew up in Cincinnati, and he taught for so many years up right up the highway, right up I-74 and in Indianapolis. And I didn't know his name at the time. It wasn't until, you know, after it was about 20 years ago or so before I even became familiar with Gordon Clark. And I thought, oh, I was so close to him. I didn't even know him at all. And of course, when did he leave Butler? He was there a number of years. Was that in the early 70s, late 60s?
Yeah, 73.
Okay. Yeah, right. I'd have been a little too young for college anyway. I'm not that old. So he was, I guess, as you said, really kind of a patriarch to a lot of the younger evangelicals who came to prominence, like Edward Carnell, as you mentioned, and a number of others through his teaching at Wheaton, and I guess really principally at Wheaton has really had his biggest influence on other evangelicals. Is that correct?
Yeah. There at Wheaton was a great influence, and really seeing him as a connecting figure between, say, the fundamentalists and the old Princeton folks in the late 19th, early 20th century, and then the evangelicals of the 20th century. Try to think of who is really there in, say, the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, and you're not going to find a lot of names. Mm-hmm. Gordon Clark, of course, his adversary friend Van Til, Machen passes away. You know, this really was, I think, a low period in a lot of ways, and people are looking for something new, right? They're trying to abandon fundamentalism, and they're looking at Karl Barth and neo-orthodoxy and all kinds of different ways of trying to be true to the faith and yet not wanting to embrace things entirely. And it's just such a relief to me in coming to Clark's thought to just say, let's just accept the Bible, just accept it as truth, rather than looking at each and every argument and each and every verse and supposed contradiction in Scripture. The real way to do this is to accept it in its entirety.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that was very influential on me when I first came to Clark, was just that idea that is your axiom, that is your starting point, is the Scripture and the Scriptures alone.
Yeah, and well, maybe to jump ahead a bit, but that's what I talk about a little bit in one of these essays on scripturalist hermeneutics. And I suppose Clark would probably agree with what I wrote here about his views on scripturalist hermeneutics, that he didn't really get into that much. But if you take the real heart of his views, if you're consistent, as he likes consistency, and you take his epistemology, I think what you'll see, as I've written here with his hermeneutics, is that it also has to be biblical. And then when you go read other hermeneutic books, they don't typically show where their principles come from. They don't show whether these are scriptural principles or logical principles or just ideas that they've come to from outside. And so really, if we're going to be focused on the Bible, as Clark is in his epistemology, let's do so also in the hermeneutics. And I think people won't like this so much because it's so restrictive. It's like, okay, well, what are we going to do about all of these linguistic studies outside of scripture and all of this Greek history and Persian history and everything else? Can't this add to the scriptures? Well, you know, Clark says, well, maybe this is useful, but it's not knowledge. And so we have to make that clear distinction of whether a hermeneutical principle is biblical or not. And then, you know, of course, do logical principles, are they entailed as well? Which essentially it has to be. You have to accept logic as a corollary to the axiom of the truth of the scriptures, or you're not going to get very far.
No, you're not. And that's a great summary of Clark's teaching on hermeneutics. So thank you for mentioning that, Doug. Now, one thing I wanted to ask you about here is in your book, you talked about, you know, when Clark came to Covenant College. And I think that was during the 74-75 school year. I know you brought up some issues. Well, how could he have been there in 74 when he was teaching somewhere else? And I think your conclusion was he probably started teaching a covenant maybe in 75 during that 74-75 school year. But you mentioned that, you know, there was a lot of interest among students. Oh, Gordon Clark's coming now. You know, here's somebody who's a philosophy professor of all things. You know, so why would students have been so excited to see this philosophy professor come and teach at Covenant College?
Yeah, I think you're off 1 year there. 73, 74.
Oh, is that it? Okay, I'm sorry. That's
somewhere in there. Just a technical.
But yeah. Okay.
So yeah, it seems like he probably maybe had accepted the job or something in 73, but he had maybe it was a prior commitment, and he taught up at Geneva College for a month and then started down at Covenant, which probably in the second half of the 73-74 school year. So yeah, if his picture's in a book from yearbook from that year, it would look like he was there in 73, but he was actually there probably in 74. So why were people interested in Gordon Clark coming? I gave that speech there at Covenant. We had a Gordon Clark symposium, and that was quite wonderful. His daughter was there, some of his former students, friends of his, many supporters of the Trinity Foundation and of Clark's written books. And I identified three different things: that Clark's philosophy being interesting, his connection to Presbyterian church history, having really been through so much and knowing so many people in the Presbyterian world. And then third, I called him an endearingly unusual individual, and that might have been interesting to people as well. And so while you have this sharp logical philosopher, he's also odd and right. It has his own quirks. Well, I don't know enough, or haven't been able to interview enough people to know precisely which of these is the dominant factor in their interest in his coming there. I would hope that it was the philosophy. I would hope that it was really an opportunity to ask this man questions and to really pick his brain and to push forward with their own thought. And that's what I would anticipate would be the primary interest. He never was asked to teach a history course or something at Covenant College. He had quite a bit of interest, I think, in Scottish history, church history, and maybe in American history as well. But I would have liked for him to teach a class on church history that he lived through, which maybe it's church present for him at the time. And, you know, bits and pieces of that come up in his discussions.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. He certainly was central to certainly Presbyterian history in the 20th century.
Yeah. To get the opportunity as he did to be inside in the PCU USA, the OPC, the United Presbyterians, the RPCES, the RPCGS, even up to the end in the Covenant Presbytery, which eventually joined the Bible Presbyterians. He got to see different aspects of Presbyterianism and know so many different people, pastors and professors and leaders of various sorts. And so he didn't have that bubble type atmosphere that we get. You know, I sometimes find it unfortunate that I didn't get to go through Christian elementary school, high school, college, seminary, all in one line of thought, as some of my friends in the Lutheran Church or perhaps in the Bible Presbyterian Church get to do. I've got to bounce around. But I find a lot of value in that. I think in Clark's case as well, studying as he did for his PhD among secular thinkers at Pennsylvania, he had a Christian professor or two. But being on the other side, right, having the modernists against him, he really got to work out his arguments. Where if you're living in a Christian bubble and you're just having affirmations all the time and only one position, it seems so obvious to you that this is the right position and you really haven't got a chance to think through these. So
right.
I think that's really helped Clark push the envelope in his thought as the challenges that came up in his life.
Yeah. You know, I think you mentioned somewhere, I believe this was in your book, where I guess Machen had said something to Clark, you know, it was a wonderful to have a man such as himself, you know, who had had this, you know, secular philosophy education, but who was also a Christian.
Yeah. And Machen saying, similarly, you're in an important position, you know, basically use this position for good. People are going to respect you. They're going to hear you. And now preach Christ. And it's fascinating to think, you know, so many different ways in which we can preach Christ in our lives. Not all of us are ministers. He later does become a minister, but that's always sort of his second profession. He's really always first a philosophy professor. And while his job usually entailed making sure the students understood Socrates and others, there's no doubt that he got onto the subject of Christ in a number of ways, both in his class and outside of the class with students at his home or students at the church.
That is such a rare thing, you know, to have that, you know, someone that has the expertise in secular philosophy, but who can also talk about Christ. You know, he can critique the secular views, you know, show where they're inadequate, show where they're inconsistent, and make a cogent, coherent argument for the Christian system of thought.
Yeah. And, you know, it's one of the challenges I had in writing this book and then considering writing more about Clark's epistemology, which may happen someday. The challenge is I'm not a philosopher, right? I think I've had three philosophy courses in my life and I've read some books. I don't have any degrees or specific training in this. And so it makes it challenging. So I hope that when people read this volume, that the philosophy will be understandable to them because it's written essentially from a lay person. I suspect some philosophers maybe will read my book and say, you know, you're preaching things that are obvious or that we all know. Well, these were not obvious to me, despite many years of researching these. And so I'm really trying to clarify, like, well, what is pre-formation theory? What is divine illumination? And there really is such a dearth of materials on these. You know, I came across this in Clark and I want to dig deeper. How do we develop a theory of divine illumination? And not that many people have done this. I really would love to see more Christians getting involved in that subject.
Well, you know, you and I kind of come at it from the same kind of a background. I was not trained in philosophy either. I know when I first came to Clark, I was like, good grief, I don't understand what it's talking about. Now, I eventually came to, but I mean, you know, it's a whole new vocabulary. It was a whole new ideas that I had never been confronted with. And that's one of the things I really appreciated about your book. And I think that people will enjoy about your book is that you do lay out some of these complex ideas. And I think you do it in a very understandable way, you know, for those of us such as myself who are not trained philosophers. So I appreciate it.
What I like so much about Clark in this relation is that there's a sense in which this is almost blue collar philosophy. And that's really just because it's truth and he calls a spade a spade. So, you know, in my essay here, right, where I write about Clark's work with Karl Barth, he'll just call it nonsense if it's nonsense, right? Where so many thinkers are trying to present these big philosophical paradigms and you read them and go, well, I don't understand this. So he must be smart or he must be right or above my head. For Clark, when I read it anyways, it clicks when it clicks, right? There's some places I don't understand very well, but in general, he is going at this from it's not common sense like realism, but a common sense way of thinking and seeking for truth, not complexities and paradoxes and other ways of thinking, but really a straightforward, and that's where the logic comes in. You know, he's working according to the logical principles of the mind.
Right, right. You know, and the thing with Clark that I've always appreciated is even though sometimes, as you said, I mean, that, you know, there are some things that can be harder to understand in Clark than others, but I've always found that if you work through Clark, you know, if you work at it, you read it, reread it, maybe look some things up, your effort is rewarded because he is logical and he is consistent. Now, there's some other people, you know, they can throw a lot of big words around and you can work and try to. And you're just chasing your tail in circles forever. But that's not the way it is with Clark. His doing the work does pay off in understanding Clark. And I've always appreciated that about him. And I appreciate that about your work on him as well. I did want to ask you here. I know we can't cover everything here in a single interview, all 15 chapters. But, you know, wanted to ask, you know, maybe what are a few the essays that you'd like to talk about, or maybe a few key points you'd like people to take away?
Yeah. Well, a few of them are philosophical essays where I'm hoping to answer some questions or push forward on occasionalism, divine illumination, pre-formation theory. But as I was rereading this, I think two of the more important essays are the one on Karl Barth, which the Trinity Foundation has already printed as a standalone article. And then number six here in the book is the Trinity in Clark and Van Til. And I'm not the guy here that has solved all the problems of the Trinity, you know, after 2000 years of work on this. But what I have done is I've outlined, I think, in a insightful way, the history of Clark and Van Til and their followers. And by looking at this, not that I've been so insightful, but by looking at each of their people's positions, especially across the Van Til, modern Van Tilians, you really start to see the problems. And I hope that will maybe turn them from some of the craziness going on. I really love in there, I quote from R. Scott Clark, unrelated to Gordon Clark, sort of a modern Van Tilian who opposes Van Til on Van Til's view of the Trinity. And R. Scott Clark says, well, if Van Til can't be said to be wrong here, then where could he possibly be wrong, right? Van Til saying the Trinity is one person in three persons. This is obviously false. Yet he has defenders of him. It's just unbelievable to the length to which a defender will go to defend their guy.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's an interesting essay. I'm like you, I don't claim to have all the answers on the Trinity, but I think that certainly Gordon Clark gives some very good, I think Clark's work on it was quite good.
Yeah. I think both in his work on the Trinity and the Incarnation, and these are the two sort of later in life that cause a lot of people to question him. I think in both of those, he's really, suggesting ways forward and wanting discussions. He's not saying this is the end of the discussion or I have all the answers. He presents his view. Here's my definition of person. It might not be great, but at least I'm giving a definition. You know, we can move forward from here.
Yes. And, you know, and that's one of the things I really appreciate about Clark, too, is he's very deliberate about making sure he defines his terms. Yeah, I've had that experience. I think probably a lot of people have. You know, sometimes you will read theologians and they use these big foot and a half long words. And I'm thinking, what does this mean? And I think, you know, and there are some times I've just wanted to give up on even trying to read theology because I don't understand it. And maybe I just can't understand it. And that was before I read Clark. And then I read Clark and I thought, wow, he's actually defining his terms. And I can when he uses a word, I know what he means by that. That is such a refreshing.
Yeah, that's sort of like the conclusion I give in this essay on Karl Barth is the Barthian response to Clark, Van Til, to anybody who critiques him. You find this with other people today. Their response is always, oh, you don't understand, right? So you've got Clark, Machen, Van Til, Zerbe, Caspar Wister Hodge, all of these guys, some of the brightest minds writing criticisms of Barth, and you're telling me they don't understand Barth. Well, then who can? Who can understand the guy? You know, and ultimately I conclude the fault's not in the reader, the fault's in the writer, or the fault's in Karl Barth.
Yeah, it's kind of like when you start criticizing, say, someone like Barth. I mean, it's like his supporters, you know, they just put out like this fog of ink, you know, kind of like, I don't know, like a squid or something like that, and they want to disappear behind it. Well, you just don't understand. Well, yeah, no, I think that, you know, I think, as you said, you know, the problem is really with the material itself. You know, it's not coherent. It's not rational.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes me feel a little bit better when I read philosophy that I can't understand. I mean, a lot of times it is our own fault. We have to admit that and say we're not that bright. But when there's a subject that you really pour into, you read and read and read, eventually you will realize a lot of authors don't really know what they're talking about. They really don't know the answers.
You don't define your terms, you don't know what you're talking about.
Precisely.
Yeah, that's a good Clarkian maxim to go by. Well, you know, what I wanted to ask you here, too, of course, you've obviously done a lot of research on Gordon Clark. This is your third book. You put out your Presbyterian Philosopher. I think it was in 2017 when that came out.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, of course, there was a second one, a book that you published with the Trinity Foundation with Tom Judaitis. It was the letters that Clark had written to various people. And also, of course, so this is your third book on Gordon Clark. So, and, you know, in the research you've done, and I know you've done tons of reading and research and writing on Clark, you know, whether it's in this book or your prior two books, what's the most surprising thing you learned about Gordon Clark? Not so much as a philosopher, as a theologian, but just as a man.
You know, one of the things in the biography that is somewhat surprising is this idea that Clark came to faith at a Billy Sunday rally. That I think is surprising to a lot of people. But that's just one small point in that book, just something, you know, brief thing that happened. As far as like in Clark's life more generally and usually, I would say one of the surprises is just the extent to which he attempted art and other subjects outside of philosophy. And I actually have here with me a Gordon Clark original. I know we're audio recorded here, but Steve, you can see this.
Yes.
I believe this is Bochius Canyon. And I was given this by Gordon Clark's grandson. I think the grandson was a little bit like, you know, what do we do with all of these paintings? We've got all of these all over the place. And, you know, this isn't the greatest painter. It might be one of the greatest philosophers, but I wouldn't want to read the philosophy of Rembrandt. I just want to have his paintings. Maybe the opposite with Gordon Clark. Yeah, maybe the answer is the artwork.
It's kind of funny. I think both things you brought up are very interesting. Now, if the idea that Gordon Clark would have come to saving faith at a Billy Sunday rally. Now, you know, I mean, Billy Sunday, he's a former Major League Baseball player. And he was, of course, he was the most, probably the most famous evangelist of you know, his time. And he was known, I guess, for being, I don't know what the right word is. He was very, enthusiastic in his presentation. I agree with you. I think that's surprising. And I think, you know, Clark did speak well of him. I know in one of his books, I can't remember where it was, but I think he made some comment to the effect of he did a lot of good talking about Billy Sunday.
Yeah. I don't know a whole lot about Billy Sunday, but I think the fact that Clark speaks positively of him is a real understanding that there are Christians who have disagreements with us, and yet they are Christians. And that's one of the things I talk about in this essay on Gordon Clark and the salvation of Arminians. And it's not really just Clark, but it's Reformed thought more broadly that understands properly the difference between salvation by faith and the salvation by faith in faith, right? We don't have to have all of our theology right or to have the most Calvinistic view in order to be saved. We need to trust in Jesus Christ. And I know some, I would call them hyper-Calvinists, who don't like this at all. But if you look in Gordon Clark, in Machen, even in Herman Hooksema and various others, you'll find that they say that Arminian Christians are saved. I think, you know, perhaps if there's some Arminian out there who's sort of aggressively promoting the heresy, that I would start to doubt things. But your average church-going member of a Methodist church, Clark would put them in the category as believers of Christ.
Well, I know that with that was you know, John's position was, you know, that Arminians are saved, you know, through a sort of blessed inconsistency. And John Robbins I'm speaking about, and that was Gordon Clark's position, and that is my position as well. And as you said, I mean, that can be very controversial in some circles. So let's see here. Oh, the artwork. You know, that was really interesting that she had that painting there. Could you show that, just because I'm going to put this out as a video as well, so it'll be there. So
he speaks about the Boquias Canyon in some places in his books, and I've been there. This is in Big Bend in Texas, Big Bend National Park, and this is right down on the border of the Rio Grande. Really quite a wonderful place. I think I remember the temperature dropping significantly when you went into that canyon and the cold waters are flowing through. You might be able to match that up with pictures of the place there. So yeah, I'm glad to have the painting.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it's actually kind of funny, though, the way you describe Gordon Clark's frustration with art. He would work and work and work, and he'd come in, and you related, I think it was, you know, about something where he came into one of the art professors or art teachers at Covenant, and he slams the book down, and he says, "How come I can't do this?" or something to that
effect. According to this book, I'm doing art perfectly, right? You know, he's following all the rules, but it doesn't work out.
That's a funny story there about Gordon Clark and his frustrations with painting. So I had a question here for you. This is kind of it was a fun question you and I had talked a little bit about. So, you know, you've written a lot about Gordon Clark. And if you were writing a screenplay on the life of Gordon Clark, what actor would you want to see play the starring role of Gordon H. Clark in your movie?
Yeah, I thought about your question, and I don't have an answer. But there's two reasons I don't have an answer. One, I don't know very many actors, right? I haven't had a television in like 12 years, and I haven't been to a movie in probably as long either. Not entirely ignorant of the scene, but also there's probably not a lot of actors who are the philosopher bookish type. So you have to find somebody who would fit that role. And, you know, there is a picture of Clark in his 20s that's, you know, very different than his other pictures, right? You know, later on, he's a 5'7", you know, small man, philosopher, nothing attractive about him. But there's a picture in his 20s, you know, where he's an attractive man. You could probably find a 20-something-year-old actor who could fit that role pretty well. But you'd have to find somebody else who could play the 60, 70-year-old philosopher. So yeah, it would be a bit of a challenge.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, you know what I was thinking a little bit about that as we were talking here. And now this is somebody who doesn't, in appearance, is nothing like what Gordon Clark is, but I think some people described Clark's personality as being a bit like Spock.
Okay. Yeah. Like Spock. I remember one person I interviewed now saying that, I think it was a student of his. They said that Clark reminded them of Alfred Hitchcock.
Well, you know, now that's something that maybe, I mean, they seem to look maybe a little bit alike, a little bit anyway, closer. But yeah, so maybe Leonard Nimoy, if he were still with us. But I don't know. I'm just like I say, I wanted just kind of a fun question because, I mean, of course, Clark was very logical. And I think that's one of the things I've heard people sometimes said, well, he reminded them a little bit of Spock.
Yeah, I think from his personality would be much Spock-like. I think maybe his way of carrying himself might have been more like Alfred Hitchcock or something. And you can imagine just the terror in the students, you know, with the smart philosophy professor coming in and this guy's going to call on me.
I mean, yes. Yes.
I think of what little I've seen of Alfred Hitchcock, and it was when I was younger. Of course, I'm scared from the show itself, but Hitchcock himself is somewhat a scary personality, like Robert Stack or something in Unsolved Mysteries. Yeah. He's scarier than the show.
It imposing, yes, yes. That's kind of an interesting combination. So we have Spock and we have Alfred Hitchcock. Some combination there. All right. Well, one thing I, you know, sort of in wrapping things up here, Doug, I just wanted to ask you, where can readers follow your work? I mean, I know that you do some things online, so where can people find your work in general?
Yeah, of course, this one, as we've already noted, is available on the Trinity Foundation. I was very pleasantly surprised to see the price come out the other day at $16.95. You can hardly find a book at that.
Yeah.
I was joking online, you should buy three of them at that price.
Yeah.
When I published the biography with Whip and Stock, they set it at $37, and I was okay. And then
let's take a look at that book. Why don't you bring that on out here?
Oh yeah, the biography. I think I have a copy here. But the biography, you know, the way Whip and Stock operates is they put the price high and then they give you discounts in the future.
Okay. Okay.
Trying to sell to libraries. But I think the Trinity Foundation has chosen a good price for the grand old dock so that it gets to the people, which is what they want. I very much appreciate the Trinity Foundation cares about truth, right? Yeah. That's that they're not looking at where they can make a lot of money or what they're going to promote to get in fashion or something like this. They want to promote biblical truth. So the book is available there. My blog, where a lot of these actually originated as essays on my blog, is just my name, douglasdauma.com. And I have a church website as well. And then our trail ministry for our hikers is discoversola.com, where we are working with Appalachian Trail hikers, preaching the gospel to them and providing them with various resources as they pass through this small village here in New York where I pastor the church. So the Lord has blessed us with lots of ministry opportunities. Yeah, we'll just see. Have to take a breath and see what's coming next.
Yes. So, that's right. That's right. And that's a very interesting ministry you have. So you live in an area where you're right by the Appalachian Trail, and you yourself are a pretty enthusiastic hiker as well.
Yeah. I wish I found the time to hike as much as I used to. Yeah. Kind of looking at a possibility at some point of doing a bigger hike again. But yeah, we're right on the Appalachian Trail. We had 288 hikers this year come by from all over the world and come to our house for shower and a bed and other things. And many of these coming also to our church, getting King James or Gideon Testaments. I think some of them are ESV, but King James Testaments and other resources from us, gospel tracts and good conversations as well as we help them out. So it's really, you know, wonderful to have two different ministries, one to the local people and the church, which is always got to be primary, is the church and real blue collar area here in New York in the mountains, upstate, according to the people in the city. And then to have also a ministry to people from all over the world that come to us. And so there is a lot of diversity. My children get to grow up among Christians, but also seeing people from every other walk of life.
Well, that's wonderful. Thanks for sharing that that aspect of your ministry. I appreciate that. All right. Well, I think that is a good place to leave it. So, Doug, thank you very much for your time. I really, truly appreciate that. And I wish you you and your family the very best going forward. And hope that you have an opportunity to write again here sometime in the not too distant future. Maybe we can sit down and talk about your next book.
I hope so. Although I mentioned, there's the idea of writing on epistemology. I would love for an enthusiastic Clarkian with a philosophy background to write that book someday. As I don't know if this will be the last of three books that I've written related to Gordon Clark. I sometimes think of the Civil War historian Ken Burns, and he says, "Well, I don't want to be known as the Civil War historian. I want to be known as the historian Ken Burns." And so maybe it's time for me to move on to other subjects. And I do have some ongoing work in sort of other Presbyterian history more broadly would be my interest, Clark being just one element of Presbyterian history. So maybe I'll write on other Presbyterian history, maybe again on Clark, but Lord knows, and Lord willing, for all those projects.
All right. Well, I look forward to seeing what the Lord does in your life and where you go with your studies in the future. So again, thanks so much for all the work you've done. I really appreciate that.
And thank you, and Lord's blessings on your work as well, especially with this Trinity Radio. It's really been wonderful. You've got the radio voice and the good questions, and been getting a lot of good people on your program as well. So I know many people look forward to it coming out each episode.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Doug. I really appreciate that. Now, for my guest, Doug Dalma, and for Tom Judaitis and everybody here at the Trinity Foundation, this is Steve Matthews. Thank you so much for joining me for this episode. I invite you to come back for the next episode of Trinity Foundation Radio. The Bible alone is the Word of God.
This is Tom Judaitis thanking you for listening to Trinity Foundation Radio. Please join host Steve Matthews next time for another episode of Trinity Foundation Radio. For more information about the Trinity Foundation, please visit our website at www.trinityfoundation.org. We have over 300 articles you can read, download, and/or print, and over 200 MP3 lectures that you can listen to, download, or you can also request CDs in the MP3 format. We also have over 65 books in print and other media which you can purchase from our website. Again, our website is www.trinityfoundation.org. And remember, the Bible alone is the Word of God. Thank you.